Thousands of workers get a raise from Amazon. But how far does $15 an hour really go in this economy? Plus, more on NAFTA 2.0 from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver today, I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, October 2nd. Good to have you with us. Before we get to the Amazon news of the day, it's worth going back to last month and a bill introduced in Congress by Senator Bernie Sanders. He called it the Stop Bad Employers by Zeroing Out Subsidies Act, also known as the Stop Bezos Act, as in Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. The bill would tax big companies whose employees rely on federal benefits like food stamps, Medicaid, or subsidized housing, which is reportedly true in some states of Amazon. The idea is to encourage those employers to pay higher wages. Well, Amazon announced today that as of November 1st, it's raising its minimum wage for U.S. employees to $15 an hour. We got Abigail Wozniak on the phone to talk about all this. She's a professor of economics at the University of Notre Dame. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Trying to understand the impact of this, though, the minimum wage in Seattle, where a lot of Amazon employees live, is already more than $15 an hour. Right. What kind of employee do you think this is going to have the biggest impact on?
So Amazon apparently has argued that a lot of their full-time warehouse workers or fulfillment center workers are already making on average over $15 an hour. So you're right that they already have quite a large swath of their workforce who would not be affected by this. They specifically mentioned part-time and temporary workers. They almost certainly will see some changes there. Those tend to be lower paid positions than the full-time positions. This should also apply to Whole Foods cashiers. And average wages for cashiers in general in the whole United States is about $10.60. So for those folks, this is likely a raise, but it's very unlikely that this is touching a large set of their core fulfillment center workers.
Amazon, in its announcement, also said it's going to lobby Congress to raise the federal minimum wage, which is just $7.25 an hour. But even without the federal wage increasing, this likely puts pressure on their competitors to do the same, right? I mean, Walmart only recently raised its minimum wage to $11 an hour. That's still quite a bit less than 15. Does this sort of speed up the movement in that direction?
Really, I think a skilled warehouse worker is already earning more than a cashier. So that's kind of one thing to keep in mind, is that Amazon is not quite in probably exactly the same labor market as Walmart is. By the same token, a lot of other firms are already announcing these types of bigger wage increases. So, for example, Target has said it wanted to get to 15 by 2020, and Costco is saying 14. So I think Amazon is in some ways just keeping pace with that.
There are lots of places where Amazon has employees that have lower minimum wages, for example, Texas. What kind of impact do you think this will have on communities where suddenly a lot of people are making more money?
Certainly, there are places where this raise will have more buying power for the employees who are affected. That, in general, should be a good thing for those local economies. It also does put some more pressure, though, on firms that might not be at a point where they are ready to pay wages that are quite that high. So I think definitely watching for effects on smaller businesses, their ability to recruit and retain workers in those kind of local markets would be an important thing to follow up after this announcement.
We're going to look at how far $15 an hour really goes for an average worker. But what kind of impact do you think this could have on the larger economy? Amazon has, 250,000 employees plus another 100,000 seasonal workers. As you've said, a lot of them are already making at least 15. But if fewer of those employees are relying on public assistance, they have more money to spend. I mean, do you see a macro effect from not just Amazon, but this larger trend?
When pay expands for workers, we have more in kind of a total wage bill that can cycle back through the economy. That's good in general for growth. We also kind of want to keep in mind what's happening with inflation. If wages go up, generally that's great, but we have been experiencing some upticks in inflation and want to kind of keep an eye on the real purchasing power of these raises for workers.
Abigail Wozniak teaches economics at Notre Dame. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Amy.
As the professor and I were discussing, Amazon isn't the only retailer raising wages, and more could follow suit. Meanwhile, more cities and states are raising their minimum pay closer to what worker advocates call a living wage. So what's it like to live on $15 an hour? Marketplace's Renata Sago talked to some of the people who would know best.
Alex Harris is 22 years old and works two part-time jobs in Florida. He makes $16 an hour as a community organizer and $9.50 at a fast food chain. He says he's able to pay his bills and bus fare, but earning $15 an hour full-time with health benefits would help.
What I just ultimately need is just a permanent job making full-time hours. Like, I feel like if I did like 40 hours every week or more, then that would make my life so much easier.
Sharon Rosinski-Peterson is 42 years old and lives in Utah. She's made $15 in the past working odd jobs and said she was able to manage as a single woman. Now that she lives with her husband and is raising two kids, she relies on renting out rooms in her home, and her parents chip in money.
If we hadn't bought this house when we did, we wouldn't be able to survive on $15 an hour. There's no way.
Back in Florida, Alexander Saunders, who works at a community center, received a raise last month after a few years of making a little over $15 an hour. The 28-year-old credits that wage with him being able to pay off his debts.
I actually just paid off last year a car loan.
But he says he wouldn't have been able to do that if he hadn't been living with three roommates.
Splitting rent with somebody was an enormous help.
While cities like New York, Los Angeles, and Seattle are mandating $15 an hour wages, the fight for 15, as it's known, continues. And now Amazon employees across the country will get to see how far the $15 wage will take them. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
We have another slice of the Amazon story online today, an explainer on monopsony. Try saying that five times fast, and why the term might relate to Amazon. On Wall Street, retailers paid a price for the promise of higher wages. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The new NAFTA, or as it's officially known, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, reached over the weekend, is already raising some complaints from north of the border. Canadians are worried their drug prices will go up. That's because one piece of the deal gives years of extended patent protection, that is, monopoly protection, to high-end expensive drugs known as biologics. That means the trade deal could delay the time it takes for cheaper generics to get to market. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Biologic drugs are complex medicines made in living cells. Think high-end immunosuppressants, anti-inflammatories. Very effective and very pricey. This trade deal would give biologic makers 10 years of patent protection in Canada and Mexico, which is longer than they enjoy now. Brian Pomper heads Action for Trade, representing pharmaceutical makers and others.
Not entirely up to what's in the United States, but I think the industry thinks that this is a real win.
A win because it would fend off competition from generics for a few extra years. That, of course, means a loss for makers of lower-priced meds known as biosimilars. In Canada, they'd have to wait an extra 2 years to get to market. Keeping prices high, says Jim Keon of the Canadian Generic Pharmaceutical Association. He says some U.S. biologic drugs make $1 billion every year in Canada.
So if you could introduce a biosimilar effectively into the market, the savings could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars just on that one product alone.
There could be another plus here for U.S. biologics makers. Using this trade deal to protect its monopoly period here at home, which is 12 years. Law professor Colleen Chen is with Santa Clara University.
If, say, a president comes into power that wants to really reduce drug prices and do it by reducing the number of years of exclusivity, she would also have to potentially break NAFTA.
Which has been rebranded, but, you know.
Well, the fact that we've got a deal with Canada and Mexico that says 10 years makes it harder for us to make that change.
Drug makers say they need that long to develop biologics. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The reworked NAFTA deal Scott was talking about is giving some people a glimmer of hope that this trade war won't drag on forever. But for companies importing steel and Chinese goods, things are still pretty uncertain. Todd Adams is vice president of Stainless Imports, Inc. It's a small family-owned stainless steel manufacturer based in Florida. We've had Todd on the show a couple of times now talking about the process of applying for an exclusion from steel tariffs. We called him up again to see how things are going. Hi, Todd.
Thanks for having me again.
Remind listeners, or for listeners who haven't heard you on the show before, what is the specific product that you applied for an exclusion for that isn't made in the U.S.?
The product is a stainless steel tube. It's for sanitary food production, essentially. It's for a dairy factory in the Midwest producing cheese. That type of tubing is produced in the U.S., but not to the dimensions that I needed for this specific project. It was exceptionally large, so it was sort of a three-headed cow, and it was outside of the capabilities of any of the American producers.
So the last time you were on Marketplace, you were scheduled to appear before Congress to talk about your application for an exclusion from these steel tariffs, which was denied. How did that appearance go?
Well, the experience, it was everything that you'd imagine, you know, the stately boardroom with hundreds of people watching you, and I think it went surprisingly well. I made my point, and there were some changes made to the exemption process that accommodated my concerns as well as the concerns of the three other companies that also testified alongside me. My main push was for the exemption requests to be retroactive to the first date they're submitted, not the first day that the Commerce Department decides to look at the request and enter it into their system. And that still didn't give me the exemption. I'm still working on that. I'm now talking to U.S. Customs for the correct import code. There was a discrepancy with that. So it's definitely a bureaucratic process, and I'm not happy yet. I'm not made whole yet, but I do feel like we made significant progress by testifying.
We've been talking about the tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. I'm wondering if the new tariffs on $200 billion worth of other Chinese goods applies to you at all. Do those tariffs affect you?
Yes. These new Section 301 tariffs do affect our day-to-day business with regards to the sanitary fittings that we provide in food factories. It's basically just led to a industry-wide price increase, which will in turn be passed down to the consumer, and it'll be reflected in the price of food.
Todd, you've been dealing with this all summer. How are you holding up?
Well, you know, at the beginning when the tariffs came out, and especially when I was left kind of holding the bag on that large order, things were tense, and there was a lot of stress. You know, that was a deal that could potentially, you know, bankrupt a small company such as mine. But, you know, with these new tariffs, I'm a little more relaxed than I have been, but it's these are still uncertain times. As I mentioned, pricing is a changing story day to day, and just overall uncertainty, which is also risk. And it's a risky environment right now to be doing business. We're holding off on major capital investments, and we're just in sort of a holding pattern.
All right, Todd Adams, we've been checking in with him about the place he's found himself in the middle of this trade war, Vice President of Stainless Imports, Inc. Good to talk with you, Todd.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Coming up,
all around the face. And then what do I do with the highlighter?
The highlighter just kind of gives it that beautiful glow.
Shining a spotlight on the $86 billion beauty business. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 122 points, 0.4%, to close at 26,773. The NASDAQ fell 37 points, nearly 0.5%, to land at 79.99. And the S&P 500 lost 1 point, pretty much unchanged, to end at 29.23. Amazon rose at first after announcing its decision to boost its minimum wage to $15 an hour. But by the end of the day, shares dropped by 1.6%. Target discounted 2%. percent. Walmart rang up 0.75%. Online clothing company Stitch Fix dressed down 35%. That's after the company announced its customer growth missed analyst targets. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.05%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. After big storms like last month's Hurricane Florence, recovery is not only slow, but expensive. Some estimates put the damage at $20 to $30 billion for Florence, and a portion of that will go to repairing the beaches affected. The U.S. government spends a lot of money repairing coastal communities after big storms. Lisa Song is a reporter for ProPublica and wrote about the high cost of beach renourishment and how that money is divvied up. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa, can you tell me what beach nourishment means?
Well, it's basically when the government comes in and they pump a lot of sand onto your beach to fix the damage to the beaches that have occurred through erosion or through storm damage. And the reason why federal, state, and local governments will fund this is that without beach nourishment, some beaches in the U.S., particularly on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast, are just getting smaller every year. They're retreating, and so the people who own property on the beach obviously want the beach to stay where it is, and those beaches are very important to the tourism economy.
How much does all this cost, and where's the money coming from?
It costs a lot. So many of these projects are mainly funded by the federal government, particularly the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA. In total, cumulatively, the U.S. has spent about $9 billion to rebuild beaches since 1923. And when we looked at the North Carolina data after Hurricane Florence, we found that in that state alone, federal, state, and local governments have spent more than $828 million cumulatively for those beaches.
Wow. And what is the argument for spending that money?
So the local residents would argue that they need that money to keep their tourism economy going, to keep their properties up, and that, you know, people from all over the country come and enjoy these beaches, so the government should help fund their economies. The people who benefit the most from these projects are actually the property owners of oceanfront properties. So these tend to be the second homes or vacation homes. Oftentimes, they're very large, pricey mansions right along the beach. They're the ones who get most of the benefit from these projects.
Why is that? Who decides which beaches to protect and which to leave alone?
This is sort of decided on a case-by-case basis. Some communities actually fund most of this work themselves through local and county taxes. And so in that case, the federal government isn't really involved. But for many communities, it's the Army Corps that decides which communities get funded. And the way the Army Corps makes these decisions, they use an economic formula that ends up favoring more affluent communities. And the reason that is that the Corps tries to see which projects can they fund where they'll get the most out of every dollar spent. So in essence, it ends up favoring more affluent communities.
And not just affluent, but predominantly white, right?
Yes. So the analysis we did in North Carolina, we looked at about 16 communities that have received funding for these projects. And the average demographics in those communities was something like 94% white.
And you found that the effect is that the same beaches just keep getting rebuilt over and over again. Can you talk about an example? Tell me about Wrightsville Beach.
Sure. Wrightsville Beach has been rebuilt, I think, more than 20 times in its history. And this is a community we found where, you know, some of the properties right along the ocean are easily worth millions of dollars.
Lisa Song, she wrote about beach nourishment for ProPublica. Thank you.
Thank you.
Fall is here, folks, according to the calendar anyway. And it's not just the leaves changing color. The new season signals a shift in fashion. This year, I'm told, it's all about big shoulders and slouchy boots. Awesome. In makeup, hello burgundies, plums, and reds. In cosmetics and skincare, new formulations for cooler weather. As Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, the way we buy those products is changing too, and the makeup industry is having to adapt.
It's midday in Manhattan, and Anastasia Tanidis has just finished a makeup run at Sephora. She picked up
some Hourglass products, a brush, blush, bronzer.
Tanidis, who was with her mom and sister, is your typical 23-year-old cosmetics buyer. She uses lots of different brands and gets her beauty advice online.
I'm kind of guilty of going on YouTube and just seeing a girl with my particular skin tone or my complexion, how it looks on them before purchasing.
Like mother, like daughter? No, says her mom, Joanna.
My generation, we stuck with one brand. Like you use Clarins or you use Lancome, where here you try the different ones and you kind of mix everything.
That shift from the department store beauty counter to the cosmetic supermarket has redefined the business, says Jenny Vrilou. She's at the Center for Customer Insights at Yale School of Management. Lou says big chains like Sephora and Ulta carry hundreds of brands, and interacting with their salespeople is like
talking to someone as if, you know, you would a friend, and just getting their perspective without feeling the sense that they're being incentivized to sell a particular brand.
That casual atmosphere is especially popular with younger shoppers, and that's creating a problem for department stores that goes far beyond the makeup counter.
A lot of department store traffic has traditionally been driven by cosmetics. So if you don't have the consumer going there for cosmetics, then she may not be going there at all.
So Saks Fifth Avenue is trying to keep its customers by moving its beauty products off the main floor and combining them with spa services like facials and eyebrow shaping. Nordstrom salespeople now handle multiple brands. And Bloomingdale's is reorganizing, Sephora style, bringing a range of products together where they're easier to mix and match.
All around the face. And then what do I do with the highlighter?
The highlighter just kind of give it that beautiful glow.
That's 65-year-old Sari Perellon getting a makeup lesson from a salesperson at Bloomingdale's.
When I'm here, you know, if I'm doing other shopping then and there is something that I need, I just buy it.
She just buys, like millions of other women and a growing number of men. The cosmetics industry brought in $86 billion in revenue last year, and it's expected to top $90 billion by 2020. Social media and smaller startups are increasingly driving that growth. Barbara Zinmore was a VP for cosmetics for Lord & Taylor. She says younger cosmetic shoppers don't just want products. They want stories.
And these indie brands usually have a founder that can speak to why she or he created the brand, why it's important to her. And those stories are very important to the business today.
So is being able to shop online. Last year, online makeup sales increased by nearly 30%, thanks to Instagram influencers and celebrities like Rihanna and Kylie Jenner. Jenner's $30 lip kits launched a billion-dollar internet business. It took L'Oreal 80 years to make that kind of money.
In every business, there's that odd, one-off, unbelievable success that who knows if you could ever replicate it. I think it's a combination of the name, the price point, the ability to see it online.
Rihanna's makeup line Fenty is right there with Jenner's. But the new players haven't exactly left the old ones behind. Fenty is owned by European conglomerate LVMH, which is also behind, yes, Sephora. And Kylie Jenner is moving into brick and mortar, Her products will soon be for sale at Ulta. In New York, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
And this final note, reports of the death of Toys R Us may have been exaggerated. The bankrupt retailer has canceled an auction of its brand name and other assets. Instead, the hedge funds that now control the company plan to revive the Toys R Us and Babies R Us brands. In court papers filed Monday, Toys R Us says it will form a new branding company to maintain existing license agreements and develop new retail businesses under the iconic names. It's been just a year since those same hedge funds decided to liquidate the company, closing 800 stores and leaving some 33,000 workers without jobs. Also no longer up for auction, Jeffrey the Giraffe, the Toys R Us mascot. All right, we got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 122 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ fell 37 points, nearly 0.5%. And the S&P 500 lost 1 point, pretty much unchanged. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.